Today on Movie While Us, we talk about The Martian and The Walk. It's time for Movie World Us. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And the SD as well.
Movie World Us is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Greetings.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, man, I've been waiting to talk about one of these movies for such a long time. The Martian.
Yes, me too.
In fact, I've been waiting to watch this movie for such a long time.
Me too.
It's one of those episodes where I just can't wait to get into the reviews. But in the before we do that, we didn't talk about last week our section where we talk about the general complaint that many people come to us with, which is there is nothing to watch on Netflix. And it's something that the three of us find particularly offensive because I think between us, we probably have about 500 movies in our collective Netflix queues, and there just doesn't seem to be any time to watch all the good stuff that's there. So it's not an advert. We do not get any money from Netflix, although I'm going to try and fix that at some point. But seriously, what a great time to be a movie watcher. The Netflix and all of these various services vying for our attention. Why don't you both tell us about a movie that you would pick if you were sitting down right now instead of listening to Movie Wallers?
Well, it wouldn't be one that I pick, but I would tell you both to watch it because I've watched it already. But I would watch this one again. So my recommendation for this week is a delightful documentary called Iris. It was released earlier this year. It's running at 97% on the tomato meter. And it is this delightful movie about a lady called Iris Apfel, who is a 93-year-old. They describe her as a style maven, who's had this amazing, I wouldn't necessarily say career, but influence on the fashion scene in New York. So not only do we get to go, you know, into Iris's house and how she spends a huge amount of time deciding what she's going to wear that day, but she has these beautiful vintage costumes, and vintage not because she bought them as vintage, but she had them when they first came out. The most amazing thing about this documentary is not only just about Iris, who is this 93-year-old woman whose zest for life is enviable, but also the fact that the documentarian is an 87-year-old, Albert Maysles, and I hope I pronounced his name well, but anyway, that's my pick. It's a delightful documentary if you like fashion, if you like clothing, if you like interesting people, if you like New York. What a great documentary. Love this.
Yazdi, what's your pick?
So my remit for the next several sessions of our Netflix recommendations is that I'm going to champion foreign films. Because I think movies in English get, you know, enough. You know, everybody watches them. And I know people have an aversion to subtitles. But I think to let that stop you from watching foreign films is doing a great disservice. I mean, last year on my list of the top 10 movies, more than half were foreign films. And the one I'm going to recommend right now is a movie which was on my list of the top 10 movies of last year. It was Brazil's submission to the Foreign Film Oscar, and it's a movie called The Way He Looks. And it's just the sweetest, most authentic movie you will watch. On the face of it, it's simply a little teenage love triangle set in Brazil. But it does everything with so much authenticity and so much heart that, you know, this movie easily rose to the top of my list. And I'll just tell you what the premise of the movie is. It is that the lead character in the movie is a blind guy, is a blind boy who is maybe 15 or 16 years of age, and he goes to a regular school, and his best friend is a girl called Anna, and he and Anna are, like, you know, very, very close, and in many ways he sees the world through Anna's eyes, and they have this unbreakable friendship between the two of them. And, you know, I've seen very few movies deal with the fact that his parents are so protective of him because they worry that being disabled, you know, that the world will be cruel to him and his classmates are cruel to him. But at the same time, they want to give him the independence because they know that they might stifle him too much. But what sets this story forward is the introduction of a new kid in school who is just so happy, just so friendly with everyone. And how many of us have been in friendships where the introduction of a third person completely changes the dynamic? Mm. And it becomes kind of this question of friendship and trust and newly emerging love. And all of this stuff is the stuff of soap opera, but it's handled so beautifully here. It's a sweet, sweet movie. I think when all movies these days are busy and hipster posturing and being cynical, this is a little gift of sweetness to everyone, the way he looks.
Added to queue instantly. Yes. That sounds wonderful.
And yes. Joe?
And Brazilian cinema is interesting. I mean, is it Latin American? I guess we call that Latin America.
Yes.
I recently watched City of God, which I know came and went years ago. But it's one that I'd missed. And oh my God, what a breathtaking piece of filmmaking that was. It was absolutely exhausting. But what a treat. And still trying to process it all in some ways, but that was terrific. But that's not my recommendation for this week.
I think Joe did the half thing that Yasti normally does.
Snuck an extra one.
Yeah, snuck an extra one.
There's so much. You squeezed in the City of God.
That was a little bit sneaky there.
There's so much. That's the problem. My pick actually is in some ways a look toward the new upcoming Steve Jobs movie. The Danny Boyle directed Aaron Sorkin script, which I think we're going to be seeing this week. The movie I'm recommending is called Steve Jobs, The Lost Interview. Anyone that knows me knows that I am fanatical about Apple and really? Steve Jobs. I have a little shrine to him in the house downstairs with a couple of ex-Apple devices.
Some candles.
But this is interesting. So a journalist interviewed Steve Jobs many, many years ago, and then their original source footage happened to go missing, only to be found somewhat cynically within a few months of Steve Jobs' death. So I'm a little cynical about the way that this came about. I feel like somebody had this buried in their garage, but nonetheless, the origins of it are secondary to what is a very candid look at Steve Jobs. This is around the time that he left Next and before he came back to Apple as what was eventually going to be one of the biggest business turnarounds in corporate history. And the cat's rustling away with the paper there, so sorry for any background noise. But it's an hour long, and if you have any interest in tech, in any interest in the whole PC industry and the way that everything came together, really great look into the mind of a genius, because here he's very open and very candid and very visionary. Remember, this interview was conducted long before we had things like iPhones and iPads, and you can see his clarity of vision just from that. So,
and is any of that covered in the book, Joe?
All of it, yeah. Again, it's a very specific moment in time. Again, this is somebody who was ousted from Apple, started his own company Next, which was having some struggles, but he'd also been at Pixar at the time. And this is about the time that Steve Jobs had his turnaround from being this kind of mercurial, fiery, ego-driven character to somebody who is a real leader. So if you have any interest in business or the tech sector, worth your while. It's an hour long, and I think you'll get a lot out of it. Anyhow, let's move on to our two movies of the week.
The Martian and The Walk.
So we have The Martian and The Walk, both of which were adapted from books, both of which were 3D. And I think I'm correct in saying that both were shot in 3D as opposed to 3D conversion. So where should we go first?
Let's do The Martian. I think we're all dying to talk about that.
Yay!
Okay, so I have the intro for that. So if by now you haven't read the book which we all have devoured by Andy, we're called The Martian. This is basically the movie of that, and it really tells off.
Just talk about the book briefly, because this is a really fascinating story. And sorry to kind of interrupt here, but Andy Weir is a first-time author. He tried to get this book noticed by publishers. He sent the first chapter to many, many publishers, as they all kind of said, no, who's going to be interested in a story like this? So they turned him down. So he self-published it a chapter at a time online, and it got some momentum. And in the end, the publishers were turning around and begging him to get the rights to publish this in paperback.
Well, he did publish the entirety of the of the book eventually on his website, and then somebody posted that on iTunes's, you know, free books, and it very quickly rose to number one. And that's when publishers realized that, you know, iTunes is giving this away for free. Why don't we sell it? And that's what it took, which is just blows my mind.
And it's a page turner. I mean, yes. I think I read this in like 5 days.
Yeah. So anyhow, sorry, Rashmi. Go ahead.
Yeah. So basically the story goes, during a mad mission to Mars, astronaut Mark Watney is presumed dead after a fierce storm, and he's left behind by his crew. But Watney has survived and finds himself stranded and alone on a hostile planet. With only meager supplies, he has to draw upon his ingenuity, wit, and spirit to subsist and find a way to signal to Earth that he's alive. I think that's really all I want to say about it. This has got an incredible cast. It's directed by Ridley Scott. And it also includes Jessica Chastain, Kristen Wiig, Kate Mara, Michael Pena, Jeff Daniels, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Donald Glover, amongst many others. And of course, Mark Watney is played by Matt Damon, who is expertly cast. Gosh, who wants to go first? I think Joe's like bursting out of his chair. So Joe, why don't you start us off with this one?
All right. So whenever you have a book that you adore converted to the big screen, it always comes with some anxiety. I think any of us that, and I don't read enough by far, I don't read much fiction, but this book got my attention and I tore through it, and like anything that I can remember in recent memory. So I approached this with a lot of anxiety. I was encouraged by some of the early press that the movie was getting, and I was also very encouraged by the caliber of people at the helm. For this one, we had Ridley Scott in his native environment, which is space. He does great stuff there. And of course, Matt Damon, who is probably as perfect a cast for this guy, Mark Watney, as I could have imagined. So going into this, it had everything to prove. And I'm glad to say that it was as good a translation of the book to the screen as I think is possible to do. Now, they had to make some enormous concessions here, and I think I'm saddened in some ways that a lot of the ingenuity of this guy's survival is missed in this movie. I think he kind of has a problem. He thinks about the problem and he solves the problem. And in the book, there's so much more detail behind the kind of scientific rationale. But that said, the rest of it just holds together. And I think the movie just builds and builds and builds to this fantastic finale where, and honestly, even though I knew exactly the way that this was going to play out, the direction and the handling and the performances just had me literally breathless and in tears, actually, at one point to the very end. So I loved, to quote Mark Watney, I loved the shit out of this thing.
Yasti.
So I think we all had very similar reactions to this story after reading the book. I mean, this is one of my favorite books of last year. And I, like you, I tore through the book. And, you know, I think therein lies the problem, is that if you like a piece of work so much, then somebody else's interpretation of that is always going to feel like infidelity in a way. So I know why the movie is the way it is, but it's not the version of the movie that was in my head while I was watching the movie. And while I understand it, it's a little bit like you're going to this restaurant which makes the best cake, and you know because it's the best cake you've ever eaten, and then what you get really is not cake but pudding. I mean, it's still very good pudding, but it's not the best cake that you wanted. So I think for what it is, I think, by the way, I would have given this 9 out of 10 had I not read the book. It's for what it is, it's something else than what the book is for me. And how can it not, right? The book is what it is in each of our different minds. But it's remarkably light-handed. It's remarkably light-handed for this story. I would have never thought that anybody would interpret The Martian in a light-handed way. It almost seems like a Universal Studios ride at some point. Again, I would not think to make a Universal Studios ride-like movie out of this particular book. But be that as it may, it's very entertaining. It's beautifully made. I would recommend it to everyone. It's a pinnacle in, you know, great, entertaining, mainstream filmmaking. But it's not the movie I wanted to see.
Yes, I agree with you.
Oh, no!
Sometimes you have so much anticipation for a movie that it's almost too hard to watch because you don't want it to be bad. Thankfully, this isn't bad at all. It's just not the greatness compared to the book, which, like I said before, was an absolute page-turner. And the problem I had is something you alluded to. The problem I had is we just don't go deep enough into the trials and tribulations of having to watch Mark survive on Mars. Everything seemed to go so smoothly, and there were a few mishaps, but we just went from scene to scene to scene with little tension and no arc. I mean, this. There are probably two ways you could have gone with this. You could have gone the Castaway route, right, which is all about Tom Hanks on an island and the human spirit, or you go this way, which to me just came across as too fun and frivolous.
Now, I've had the advantage, and I'm going to call it an advantage, of seeing this film twice in the movie theater. I caught the press screening when it originally showed here, and I saw it again with Rashmi when she got back from her travels. So I've seen it twice, and you know what? Some of what you experienced that I was with you on the first watching, on the second watching, there is a lot packed into this movie in terms of visual storytelling. And we talk about, you know, the idea of show, not tell. Whenever you talk about screenwriting, there's show, not tell. There is so much going on in this movie visually that is not stated explicitly that it filled in some of the gaps where I think I would have ultimately been disappointed if this, like, the movie went up at least a point on second watching just because I caught so many of the little things that I was looking for that first watching. In terms of the tension and even emotionally, it affected me more the second time round. I didn't cry the first watching, but the second watching that we had towards the end, I was tearing up in a way that was that's remained with me, which is kind of odd given that this is a sci-fi blockbuster.
I mean, the first part of the book is a first-person narrative. And so I think the movie retains a lot of what keeps us going as we're reading the book is the humor in Mark Watney. But it's not just the humor. It's humor in the face of, you know, unthinkable
extreme adversity.
And the movie kind of abandons that adversity and only concentrates on the humor. So it comes off feeling a little frivolous. And maybe I need to see it again, but I have, and again, I love the movie for what it is. I love the pudding that it is, but I wanted the cake. But
great analogy.
I think the movie for me, three things actually. The first thing is what you said. I think they should have made this into a television series. There is too much content here. This is this person's journey at two separate junctures. And I think trying to squish everything in a 2-hour, 20-minute movie is too long. The second thing is, necessarily so I understand, but the movie really dumbs down the science. There's virtually no science here. I mean, I'm a geek, right? And I love the book because it's a lot of it is chemistry.
Yeah.
And I understand it's not going to go anywhere with your typical movie audience, but it just felt very dumbed down to me. Like,
yeah,
you know,
but Breaking Bad was a loved program, right? So, I mean, I think if an audience, a mainstream TV audience can accept Breaking Bad for the amount of science that had in it, then there should have been no reason to back away from it in the movie. Yeah.
And then the other pieces, I understand for commercial reasons, they could not make an R-rated movie, but really they have kind of scrubbed it off any profanity, which takes away from, I mean, this book has one of the best opening lines, right? And I wanted the movie to open with that opening line, but they never open with it because it has a piece of profanity in it. And I wish they would have just embraced the F's and, you know, made it an R-rated movie. But
well, there are two.
Yes, that's all.
But they're not the ones you wanted.
Right, they're not the ones I wanted. They're kind of, one of the F words is not even in the book. But anyway, I know they needed to make a PG-13 movie, so I understand. But it kind of feels like it was a little downgraded on both of those counts.
Yeah, my issue is, look, you've employed people like Jessica Chastain, Chiwetel Ejiofor. This is a grand cast, and so you're compelled to use them. And so as a result of that, we end up spending less time with Mark Watney on Mars and more time everywhere else where all of these other people are. I get that. I think the other piece that made this more disposable, and I use the word frivolous, is its unabashed use of 70s music. There's a clear reason why we have... No, I understand the 70s music was left because it was supposed to be one of the crew members. But that doesn't mean that you use it entirely throughout the movie, right? It doesn't make sense.
But wasn't that music in your head while you were reading the
no.
book? Okay, it well, was for me. It was totally no. there for me.
No, and it's fine if you use it while you're on Mars, but we use it all the time. And I think that makes it feel like a disco ball, and it makes it very disposable.
It lightens the movie.
It does, and I think it makes it disposable as a result. And this really is a good movie, like Castaway, and I keep coming back to Castaway. This movie should have devastated me, because the book devastated me. And I didn't feel devastated at all, and I never felt the tension that he's gonna get back, or they're gonna rescue him. I mean, it just made it so disposable. I think that's my biggest criticism of the movie.
I will grant you what you said, though, Joe, that even at the first viewing, I think the last half hour is splendid.
I agree.
It's you know, this is why the new filmmakers should watch the season ones. This is how you do pacing.
Yes.
You know, it's paced beautifully, even the way the scenes are cut. They are long scenes. And as it gets closer and closer to the end, it becomes those scenes get cut shorter and shorter. And it's, you know, actually, when you think about it, you know, the book only says so much. And you're right, they have to fill in the spaces visually, because the book doesn't describe how the rest of this, you know, the hub looks, or how, you know, the MAV 6 or whatever looks. So there's a lot of pieces that are filled in, and it's very effective. I guess, for me, this was like an existential thriller, and the movie I got was an entertaining thriller, and I didn't expect that existential piece to be turned into entertainment, albeit it's very, very good entertainment. So that's my issue.
Visually, what about that? I mean, I think Ridley Scott created for me very much it was exactly the way that I'd imagined it, mm-hmm. and that's kind of an interesting thing for me, because oftentimes my biggest disappointment when I do see a book taken from, you know, the written word to the screen, it looks different. It feels different. The places and the environments are different. And everything here was mm-hmm. amazingly close to what was described in the book, which I think maybe we can credit the writer for being so visual in his descriptions. But in some ways, I can't wait to go back and reread the book now that I have this visual that goes along with it that is so well in tune with what was written.
Yeah, I guess what was interesting for me was the first trailers had already come out and the posters had come out by the time I started reading the book. And that was the impetus for me to finish reading the book, even though it didn't need impetus once I read that first page. I mean, I have to say the scale of this is incredible and second to none. And the cinematography is stunning.
3D is not something that I advocate at all in movie theaters, but the fact that they shot this in 3D, it's visually, it's wonderfully done. I mean, it creates, I felt like especially the second time watching it, I felt like I had taken a trip to Mars, which is such a bizarre thing to say, but I really did enjoy the whole look of the film, but especially the way that they use the depth of field. Especially there's moments when he's in the rover, there's moments when he's looking out over this Martian landscape that looks so foreboding and hostile. And again, visually, it was a real treat.
Yeah, and I have to say, Joe was really annoying, because when I was picking the time that I wanted to go and see the movie, he was over my shoulder making sure I'd watch 3D, IMAX, Atmos, Dolby, whatever. And I was like, look, I can get this show at 11 o'clock and get it over and done with. No, I had to go to that one. But thank you very much. I think it really did add to the experience of the movie, so I appreciate that. So 3D, I'll be as annoying as Joe. You must watch this movie in 3D, Dolby Atmos, IMAX.
Yeah, at least 3D.
At least 3D.
Yeah, I mean, you say this many times, Joe, go find the biggest, baddest movie theater, you know, in your neighborhood to go see this movie. Can we talk a minute about the casting?
Vincent Kapoor.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. But I think, you know, Damon doesn't get a lot of credit. You know, he's been in the business for, like, gosh, decades now. And, you know, I can't honestly think of somebody else who, I think if Clooney was in this, or Michael Fassbender was in it, or even Mark Wahlberg was in it, it would have been a very different movie. I think he kind of grounds it with authenticity. And I think he is the right actor. I just wish they would have let him be a little bit more darker in terms of what he was going through. But that's my general, you know, comment about the whole movie.
That to me is one of the beautiful things about this story, because despite the adversity and the overwhelming odds, Mark Watney in the book is never, ever down on things. He's not. There may be maybe a moment or two, but for the most part, this is the human spirit in a way that we don't often see in tragic circumstances. He is fighting consistently for survival in a way that is ingenious, but he has this sense of humor to him that I think the movie did really well here. So I didn't want a darker interpretation of this.
It did, but when I was reading the book, it was very clear to me that he was being funny because anything else would make him kill himself. He had to be funny because the situation he was in was so grave that that was his defense mechanism to just kind of laugh through it.
And you didn't get that from Damon's performance, because I got nothing but that from Damon's performance. Especially, you know, moment there's this big finale where, you know, he is in a really, really dangerous situation involving, I'll just say, it involves a tarpaulin.
Right.
But he is frightened. He's still cracking jokes, but he's frightened.
I wanted him to be frightened from the start.
You didn't get that?
He seemed a little too well adjusted to me on Mars.
That was my comment, which was we just went from scene to scene to scene without tension until right at the end. I agree. Tension came right at the end. But other than that, we just went from scene to scene to scene.
What about the rest of the cast? I mean, I'm totally in love with Jessica Chastain, with what she did with Lewis. I love Michael Peña, what he did with that character.
Little small roles.
Of Martinez. Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Kate Mara was good. Yes.
They were all really terrifically cast. I'm a bit annoyed that they didn't cast an Indian in the role of Venkat Kapoor. They changed the character to Vincent Kapoor.
That really bothered me.
Because there are so many fine Indian actors, and I'm not an advocate for Indian actors in any way, shape, or form, but there are so many that could have played this role brilliantly.
And, you know, I think we should be colorblind. That's fine, but it just seems, you know, if it was like there was nobody else around who could have done this, then it was something. But it just seems so random that they picked a British African-American actor to play an Indian, a South Indian, you know, character. But Kristen Wiig, bless her heart, she's so good. But what was she doing here? She was just standing around in the whole movie. She's just literally standing around.
But wasn't she that character?
She was, but she's just standing. I felt bad. I'm like, she's so hovering at the edge of the frame through most of the movie.
That character didn't have a lot to do in the movie as compared to the book. But was she not Annie?
She was Annie. Yeah, Mindy Park was not Mindy Park, though. Anyway.
Sorry, I'm
So do we think this is going to get Oscar love? I mean, I guess we're getting into the end of the year now. Is this set for Oscar love?
If I had anything to say, it'll be on the Best Picture list. I don't know that it will be up for anything else non-technical. There may be some technical accolades here, but I mean, for me, it's going to end up on my Best 10 list, clearly. I mean, this is my stuff. This is made for me.
Better than Interstellar?
I was just going to go there, but carry on.
Well, I saw an interesting quote recently that Interstellar.
Joe looks embarrassed when we asked him that question.
So Interstellar,
it's like asking to choose between two children.
The Martian, and what's the other one? There's three films that are all about saving Matt Damon. But
Saving Private Ryan.
You know, I rewatched Interstellar in anticipation because I have the Blu-ray and I love the movie.
I was traveling.
Sorry. Yes, carry on. Yes.
And what did I say to you, Rashmi, after rewatching Interstellar?
You said, this is brilliant. You have to watch this when you come back. And I said, I'm so far, I'm thousands of miles away.
No, not only that, but I said that this is an underrated masterpiece. Interstellar is...
Sorry. Okay. It is. No. It probably is.
When you look at the movie without the sense of anticipation that was around it, and you look at it in kind of a more objective light, you realize that the main antagonist in this movie is actually time, and you look at the way that this whole thing comes out, it's absolutely brilliant. It falls at the end because of its ending, because of this whole bookshelf through time that gets a little trippy and weird, but the rest of the movie is brilliantly assembled, and it has a mood to it that I think is going to be a future classic. And you can quote me on this in 10 years time, but Interstellar is very, very special.
Okay, but this is the Martian review.
Yeah.
So
You asked me.
Which is better? I did ask you.
Clearly, you know, and in terms of, oh gosh, that's a really unfair question, because I love them both.
Yeah.
But I have to say that I, in the theater at least, I enjoyed The Martian more.
Yeah. I think The Martian is more accessible.
Yeah. Well, I kind of felt happy for Jessica Chastain that she got to go to space this time.
That's right.
That's true, instead of whining and crying. But yeah. Yeah, I think this is a very accessible movie. I mean, I think there is nobody I would not recommend this movie to. You know, it's just a good, well-crafted, fun ride.
Yeah.
It's not what I wanted, but it is what it is.
Okay, score then, Yazzie. That sounds like a bit of a summing up.
So, you know, this is not, again, I'm going to repeat, this is not the movie I expected, but it's such a good little thriller. And, you know, many reviews have said this already, but Ridley Scott has made the two big defining seminal sci-fi classics of our time, Alien, followed two years later by Blade Runner. I don't think this is his third classic, but I think this is the one which more people will see than both of those movies combined. It's already been the number one movie 2 years in a row. I mean, sorry, 2 weeks in a row. And I think if it catches on, this could be a huge, huge, huge hit. I wouldn't be surprised if, or I'd be happy, I think, if Matt Damon gets some awards recognition, maybe even a nomination. So, gosh, it's... I'll give it an 8 out of 10. A very, very generous 8 out of 10. Very generous. I would have given it a 7, but 8 out of 10.
Joe?
I mean, this is for me in the same way that this universe is for Ridley Scott. This is where he does his best work. He reminded me... did anyone notice the opening? The kind of the sound and the way that we first see the landscape of Mars. Did that not feel reminiscent of Aliens in any way to you? Maybe not. There's this just little orchestral, flutey sound. Anyway, Ridley Scott does this stuff better than many, many directors out there. I mean, this is what he does brilliantly. He does sci-fi in a way that's real. He brought the pages of the book to life for me in a way that, other than perhaps not getting down and dirty with the science, was just super satisfying. So for me, an easy 9 out of 10. I'm not going to give this the 10, because I don't believe this elevates movie making in any real way. But boy, did I enjoy the heck out of this. I can't wait to watch it again. And that's after seeing it twice. My stuff.
So I would say overall a good attempt at a great book. Not brilliant, but very good and way more superior than something like Gravity. From a few years ago. That's the other one I would compare this to. I think 7 is being a bit mean. 8 is probably too much, but I'll give it a 7. I think 7 is probably where it sits with me. And I would give the book a 10.
Yeah, I would give the book a 10 as well. I think the reason why I give it an 8 is because even though it dumbs things down, at the end of it, there are two things that the movie does really well, which maybe the book never intended to. But one is that I think a little kid watching this movie may want to join NASA.
Mm-hmm.
It kind and better than in, you know, little kid watching Interstellar may not necessarily want to join NASA, but I think a little kid watching this movie may want to join NASA, and I think it kind of makes science cool, and it makes science something which is a matter of life and death, and so I like that it champions the cerebral,
even
the scientific
botany.
Part, even botany. So I like that it's kind of, you know, doing a hi-fi to the nerds of the world. So I like that. And the second thing I really liked is, and, you know, the trailers give it away, and so it's not a spoiler, but everybody knows that the second part of the movie is about bringing him back to Earth. And I like that it builds a sense of camaraderie within the world. Like, the movie does this much better than the book did. It brings a sense of all these people around the world putting their heads together, coming together to save this single person. So I think the movie kind of conveyed the sense of we can be better than our differences. And maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it really gave me that sense of, you know, we are the world.
With the OJ's Love Train playing in the background.
Yes.
Oh, you just spoiled that for me now.
No, I mean, just one final thing. I do agree that the weight of expectations of this movie from people who enjoyed the book can take it down a notch or two. To which I say the best remedy is seeing it a second time, because I really did. This was an 8 out of 10 for me as well. Seeing it the second time really packed a wallop. And I can only say that with the experience of having watched it a second time, just to see all the stuff that you missed. Moving on.
Another one that you watched twice.
Movie number two is The Walk. So The Walk is the story of Philippe Petit. So there was a documentary a couple of years ago, maybe a little longer than that, called Man on Wire. It was Oscar nominated, I think. Did it actually win that year?
It won Best Documentary that year.
So it's a movie that I think all of us have seen, and it's about a funny little Frenchman who has a curious obsession with balancing, juggling, circus, but most of all, high wire acts. And the story of the documentary, which was based in turn on the book that he wrote about his experience, or that was written about him and this experience, is turned into a narrative movie here, directed by Robert Zemeckis of, yes, that Robert Zemeckis, the Back to the Future and many, many, many other things fame. And essentially tells a story about Philippe Petit's walk between, on a high wire, the two towers of the World Trade Center in 1973. So the movie stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Charlotte Le Bon, Ben Kingsley, and a bunch of other folks. Guys, what did you think of The Walk?
So rather like The Martian, I mean, for me, Man on Wire was such a fantastic documentary that stayed with me for a long, long time. That I came out of The Walk thinking it's not bad, it's just too precious. And it's working way over time to entertain you at the expense of gimmickiness and a really bad French accent from Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I liked it. I didn't love it.
Jesse?
I had a strange experience with it. I'm a fan of Man on Wire. I really like that documentary. So I knew exactly how this was going to play out. And so by virtue of that, the first 45 minutes of the movie was insufferable. I could not. And I am probably the world's biggest defender of Joseph Gordon-Levitt. But that character just came off as such a caricature. I mean, the accent and the mannerisms, and it was too affected. Now, Philippe Petit, the actual guy in the documentary, we recognize he's like your quintessential Frenchman. Like he could all, you know, he was like a mime, right, initially. Mm-hmm. But even then, I really had a difficult time with the first 45 minutes. But then I have to acknowledge the fact that the latter part of the movie does such a great job by way of craft that even though I knew exactly how this played out, I bought it. We were talking during The Martian that, you know, we all hate 3D for the most part when it's used, you know, nominally. But I think even more so than The Martian, it's critical that if you do see The Walk, you should see it in 3D, because there are scenes where he is stepping out on this wire, you know, between the two twin towers. And I felt queasy. I really felt queasy because I felt like I was the one putting my feet on top. So we are so jaded by, you know, CGI and, you know, things exploding and burning and us being on top of mountains and clouds and whatever in superhero movies. But to create this sense of verisimilitude that you always talk about, this movie does a really good job. So I'm very impressed by the craft of it, as much as I don't care about the early emotionality of it.
Jeff?
What Yazdi said. I mean, this movie doesn't hold well together as a movie in the sense of, I didn't find it insufferable, Yazdi, but I did find the whole thing very disposable. I didn't buy any of the stuff that was leading up to what is essentially a heist. The heist itself was done reasonably well, but not as well as the story was told in Man on Wire, where I had true anxiety listening to the way that this story unraveled and what went on. But the movie's finale is spectacular, and it's worth the price of admission alone because, this is as good a case for the use of 3D that I've ever seen. And I'm not, I hate it. I hate the glasses. I hate the experience. I hate the lack of brightness. I hate everything about 3D for the most part is just annoying to me. And yet in this movie, like you, Yazdi, I was at one point, I wasn't queasy, but I had vertigo and I really felt very, very uneasy in my seat in the cinema, looking down those twin towers and imagining what it must have been like to be on that wire. So in terms of spectacle, this movie is so powerful, but as a movie, it's good enough to get us there. But if you don't see this in 3D, in IMAX, in a movie theater, then don't bother. Yeah. Please forget it. This is not going to be a Netflix recommendation for me when it comes out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, I think I had the same problem with this one that I had with Martian, which is it was too frivolous. And it was all about the game. You know, we always talk about the game in a movie or a scene. It didn't go deep enough. The incredible thing about Man on Wire was this person who has this unquenchable thirst to do something incredibly dangerous, not just for him, but the risk that he puts everyone else at as well. And I just didn't get that from this. The black and white, the colored rope, the fake accent, just everything was so annoying. And I'm kind of trying to put myself in the position where, had I not seen Man on Wire, what would I think about the movie then? Which is always difficult to do because we have seen Man on Wire. I think I would have been a little bit less annoyed, maybe if I hadn't seen the amazing documentary Man on Wire. I think the only really good thing about this movie, other than what you've said about the 3D and the cinematography of that and the craft, is Ben Kingsley. I thought he was great in this movie, especially because I didn't like him in Learning to Drive, which we saw, you know, about a month ago.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things which is a lost opportunity in the movie, and I do recommend this movie, one of the things which is a lost opportunity is exactly in terms of conveying, you know, there are some people who have a wildness in their heart, right? They are the ones who are jumping off of mountains, you know, with skis on. They are the people who are, you know, pushing every sport to its limit, knowing that and every time they're doing it, they have at least a half, if not more, likelihood of death. And these are people who just, they live by the thrill of that adrenaline. They are possessed. They cannot help but not do it. And you can get that sense from watching the documentary that this guy was just possessed. He was looking for that next challenge. And the next challenge was literally to walk across a wire between, you know, the topmost levels of the two twin towers. And I wish the movie had somehow conveyed the psychology of this man who could not help but do this. You know, he was, I think the only way you would do this is if you were irrationally compelled to do it, that there was no other option to not do it. And in this movie, it just all seemed like something he was doing, like, you know, like you're going for a hike, you know, at Yosemite. So it seemed, so that I wish that that's a lost opportunity. And the second piece, why don't you respond to that? And I'll go to
Exactly. And I think just to add to that, there was something that Man on Wire captured that this movie failed to capture, which was his ability to control the world around him, to control the behaviors of the people around him, to get them. And he refers to them in the movie as accomplices, but they really were partaking in a crime that he was literally some kind of cult leader that, like, the things that he got these people to do.
It's dangerous. It's very
the magnetism of his personality and his sheer force of will didn't come across well in this movie. Again, it was done adequately, but it was done more through the use of the word accomplice than through the strength of personality that this particular individual has that came through every frame of Man of Wire.
I mean, I find myself, and yes, I know you want to make another point. I find myself thinking, why make this? Why make a movie version of a documentary that's perfection? And the only
3D,
the only thing I can think of, and the one thing that did come across to me, now, Joe, maybe this is because we lived in the proximity of the towers at one point, and we loved those towers, was the love of the towers, right? And that did come through as a theme throughout the movie. And there's a beautiful closing scene, which is the sun setting on the towers. That made me cry. because I love those towers. You know, we would be there all the time taking pictures of them. And to lose them was a big loss. And so I can only think that maybe this is someone's love letter in some way to the towers. That's the only way I can kind of rationalize this movie being made, because the documentary is perfection. That's the only thing that I can think of. Sorry, Esther, you wanted to make another
point. No, I can respond to that. I think as overcooked and overdone as the movie is, it's remarkable that it's very, very... It almost doesn't say anything about the Twin Towers, and yet everybody leaving the movie will have a knot in their throat, because, you know, it speaks to an earlier time which was more innocent. And I think... I think this is a piece of dialogue verbatim from the documentary, which is repeated in the movie, where somebody says that the Twin Towers were just these ugly blocks of buildings. They're not architecturally very pleasing. They were just like two square pieces. But after Philippe Petit walked across it, he kind of gave life to them. Yeah. And I think that's kind of conveyed pretty decently in the movie. But the other piece I want to make is, you know, you said this earlier in our previous podcast, which is that, you know, the mantra is, you know, show, don't tell. And the movie starts with telling, and it keeps telling. And that whole device of Philippe Petit standing on the Empire State, talking at us.
No, it's on the Statue of Liberty.
Sorry, Statue of Liberty, and talking to us. It was completely unnecessary. Like people who don't know better cinema do that. I mean, this is... You know, Robert Zemeckis has been at the forefront of technology for a long... I don't know why he had him stand at the Statue of Liberty and talk.
Choice.
And it didn't... It
so annoying.
It brought the movie down, I thought.
Well, you know, viewed cynically, I agree. It's a lazy way of filling in some of the details that were not shot. So, you know, everyone accuses directors of being lazy when they do things like voiceovers, narration, and I don't know, I think... I'm not as hard on the movie as I would be ordinarily there, because we get much of Petit's personality from those scenes. I think it introduces him in a way, and it helps fill in the blanks that I think would have been very difficult to tell without making this movie 3 hours. So I don't know. I mean, I wasn't as offended by that gimmick as perhaps others were. I mean...
I just found... Joseph Gordon-Levitt so difficult to watch facially. I don't know if they had done prosthetics or something on him. Not that they made him look more like Philippe Petit. It was just very, very disturbing to watch him. And like you, Yazdi, I love Joseph Gordon-Levitt. In fact, we were lucky enough to meet him. But, you know, very nice chap, and I couldn't watch him.
I got over it in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
His accent was awful. Wasn't awful. But his accent was not convincingly French. But then I was over it, and I'm like, it's not going to get any better. Right. And so, okay, you're a Frenchman. I got it. And
you had to watch it twice.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I think other than the fact that I didn't get the vertigo the second time I watched it, it was still worth that fairground ride final third.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else or ready to wrap up? Joe, why don't you go first?
So we've said it all. I think the movie itself is adequate, but it really exists only to give us a 3D spectacle, the likes of which, and I'm going to sound like a bit of a circus promoter, you know, roll up, come see the 3D spectacle. But I just haven't seen this in a movie theater to the extent that I've felt literally giddy in my seat trying to deal with the danger of a scene that can't be done two-dimensionally. So if nothing else, this is a first real convincing argument for the use of a third dimension in a movie. And for that, I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10. But like I said at the beginning of my review, if you can't see this in an IMAX 3D screen, then don't bother. You're not going to watch this on the back of an airplane. You're not going to watch it on your home TV set. It's just not going to work as well for you. Watch Man on Wire instead.
So Rashmi, you said earlier that, you know, why did they feel the need to make this movie? I think because the story needs to be told and not enough people are going to watch a documentary.
Mm.
And I think Robert Zemeckis has always been looking to make movies which pushes the craft a little bit to tell the story better. I mean, he did this real throwaway of a movie with Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn and Bruce Willis called
Death Becomes Her. I love that movie.
It's a little throwaway fun movie.
Yeah.
But the whole premise of the movie is that, you know, the second half of the movie, Meryl Streep has a big hole. Meryl Streep or Goldie Hawn? Somebody has a big hole.
Goldie Hawn.
Goldie Hawn, her insides get blown up.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
And technically, the movie is flawless because you can see through what's behind her. And it's so convincing. And I think Robert Zemeckis saw this as an opportunity to use 3D to tell this story and give people the sense of what it might be to literally
step out
from the edge, from the topmost terrace of the, you know, of the World Trade Center building. So I think that's what probably drove him. And maybe some of it comes from the fact that, you know, the Twin Towers are so now embroiled with how we live right now and what's happened to us in the last decade, that to kind of go back and talk about a story which has nothing to do with terror, but something more innocent, is probably why he did it. So based on all of that, I hated the first 25 minutes of it, but I'm enthralled by the craft of it. I give it an 8 out of 10.
Overall, this is too whimsical a movie to convey what a really interesting, unique person Monsieur Petit is. But it's fun at times. It's not nearly as good as the documentary Man on Wire, and so I would recommend that people watch Man on Wire instead. But I agree with what you're saying about the 3D. I think a 7 out of 10.
The same as The Martian.
Yeah. Yeah, for the fact that I was disappointed for the same reasons in both.
We're going to have some serious discussions in this house after this podcast.
and also, what a lost opportunity. I love it when movies based on real life events show photographs of the actual people at the end.
Yes.
I wish they'd done that.
Yeah,
I
was kind of a missed opportunity too, because I didn't remember Annie from the
documentary,
but she was such a pivotal character here in terms of his arc. Okay, well, do let us know what you think of these movies, The Martian and The Walk.
And our Netflix picks.
So let's just recap what they were.
Iris.
The Way That He Looks.
And Steve Jobs, The Lost Interview.
And your sneaky one.
Oh, City of God, the Brazilian movie from years and years ago. All right, and let us know what you think of the podcast. Mail at movieballers.com, twitter.com/movieballers, facebook.com/movieballers as well. Until our next episode, too many movies.
Too little time.
Good night from me.
And me.
And me as well.